Check Lovers. I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I write novels, and on this show, I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. Today, Judy Battalion and her debut novel, The Last Woman of Warsaw. Later in the show, in our brand new segment, The Book Biz, we'll also talk to Rachel Cantor, the founder and owner of Lovestruck Books, about digital-first publishing. But first, let's talk to Judy Battalion, the author of The Last Woman of Warsaw. This novel follows two very different Jewish women in Warsaw in the late 1930s as they search for a shared mentor, a third very elusive woman. A setting that gives us a real view into life in Poland before World War II. Judy, I am so, so excited to have you here on Check This Out. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
Judy was actually one of my very first guests ever back when I was doing this show, like in my closet converted to my office studio before I was picked up by NHPR. And she was on for her first nonfiction, The Light of Days. It was so nice. She was so gracious to be on my show back when I was just starting. So, Judy, we're in very different places now, and I'm thrilled that you're back. Let's start by talking about the setting of this book. So The Last Woman of Warsaw is set in 1938. We are in Poland. And what blows my mind about this time period is that Poland is really only 20 years old into Polish independence at this point. And I think we tend to forget that a lot when we talk about Poland and World War II, because the country used to actually be carved up between Russia, Prussia, and Austria. So let's talk about Poland as a brand new country in the 30s.
Sure. So Poland was new. Poland was a new republic after World War I. And this was very exciting for the Polish population, but it was also a little bit confusing. Who are we? Are we a nation of purebred Polish people? Are we going to accept diversity? Poland had many minorities in the region that was now Poland. Who are we going to be? What kind of government are we going to have? Are we going to be a democracy? They tried that. It didn't quite work. It was run by, there was a coup. It was run by a kind of benevolent, some say, authoritarian leader till he died in 1935. His name was Pilsudski. And then when he died, it left a real power vacuum. It left a real confusion in the country. And you had many very right-wing groups who are starting to gain popularity and push themselves around this time. So the country, in a very brief period, just those 20 interwar years, goes through different political and governmental structures. It's really trying to find itself.
And in Poland in 1938, because it really was carved up between Russia, Prussia, Austria, now it's sandwiched between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, right? You have lots of different sort of nation, like people affiliated with different kinds of countries living all together and now saying we're Polish, right? But some people who think they've been Polish all along. Let's talk about that, sort of how people identify who live in Poland in 1938.
Right, of course. So Poland becomes a country. It's kind of carved out like a number of countries in that region. I think I had a joke in The Light of Days. There are they say, so, you know, are we Russia or are we Poland this year? And say, no, we're Poland. It says, oh, thank God, I can't deal with another Russian winter. I mean, it was a little bit arbitrary. So suddenly Poland gets its land after World War I, and this land includes a very large proportion of a Ukrainian population. And you have a German population and a Russian population. And Poland, as carved out at that time, is 10% Jewish population. So 10% of the country is Jewish. So that's huge. That's actually a huge minority number. So you have a country that is diverse.
And lots of languages and competing sort of definitions for what it means to be Polish. Like, what do we fight for when we say we want to fight to be Poland? Because I think your characters in your book, The Last Woman of Warsaw, are really caught up in this. What does it mean to be Polish? Am I Polish?
Am I Polish? I read some really interesting takes from the time that, you know, they were very, the Poles, there was a strong feeling that there was a real Polish pride and identity that had been kind of sustained through the country having been chopped up and placed under other empires for decades prior. And now they were going to be able to celebrate their Polish language and literature and art. And that was very important.
Right. So we're going to talk about this 10% of the population that was Jewish, and your two characters in your the characters in your book are Jewish. But I want to take another minute to really talk about the scene, because, again, this was so fascinating to me in your debut novel, The Last Woman of Warsaw. We are in 1938 Poland, and you just touched on this. There's this booming art scene, right? What does it mean to be Polish? And a lot of the ways that that's being expressed is through art, theater, photography, right? I don't know, writing of all kinds. Let's talk about that huge art boom and what that felt like to be in Poland.
So this really blew my mind. And by the way, I want to start by saying all four of my grandparents were born, raised, and grew up as young adults in Poland. So I have a real emotional and an actual connection to the country. And yet I had no idea. I had this kind of preconceived notion that interwar Poland, Poland in the 1930s, was a bit fiddler on the roof. It was a little bit small town, and the Jewish community was very religious, and no one was, I don't know, worldly. It wasn't true at all. And as soon as I started to dive into this period, I was so taken, in particular, by Warsaw. Warsaw, also where all four of my grandparents lived. So again, there's an emotional connection to this city. Warsaw, which was about 30%+ Jewish in its population, was a city, a cultural hub. And we don't really think about it that way, I think, or I hadn't. Theater, vaudeville, cabaret, nightclubs with revolving dance floors and colorful cocktails, fashion. It was called the Paris of the North. And there was even a cafe that opened up, the Art and Fashion Cafe. And the Fashion Cafe, it was a real setting, and one of my favorite settings that I adopted into the novel. People hung out at the Fashion Cafe. My main character, Fanny, hangs out at the Fashion Cafe. She's an aspiring fashion photographer.
It's amazing the energy that was in that city. And then you introduce us to the city. You take us to 1938 Warsaw through your debut novel, The Last Woman of Warsaw. If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. We're talking to Judy Battalion, the author of this novel, The Last Woman of Warsaw, and you're listening to Check This Out on New Hampshire Public Radio. Can you introduce us to the moment we meet these two women in the very beginning of the book? Can you read for us?
Let's give it a go. Geneva, August 30th, 1939. Warsaw, Milan, two tickets. She sat at the mahogany desk, thumbing the slips of paper, immeasurably thin yet thick with her entire future. Out the window before her, a grand boulevard, elegant cupolas, shop fronts flaunting sophistication, balconies bedecked in floral arrangements and ombre no less, hues leaking seamlessly into each other. Soon, at dusk, the manicured lawns and magical lakes would give way to dazzling lights and the murmurs of champagne toasts. Picture perfect. It's all how you frame it. She took it in, capturing the serenity. Click. East back to Warsaw, or south to Milan. What had she learned this past year? To follow her gut. Out the window, smartly dressed women strolled along the even sidewalks with ease. She watched one woman cross the street, her coat end flapping just so, the triangle of contrast perfect. She was hardly rattled when she arrived an instant too late for her tram. An instant. All of fate was determined by moments. She knew this. She'd felt this. But it was the rare time when you were consciously treading on the turning point, when you knew the choice mattered. Warsaw, Milan, sweating, palpitating, she could hear her own heartbeat. She recalled, he'd come in late last night, his stubble already angling for a morning shave. He was clutching the certificate, the ticket. Hitler is through the gate, strolling up Poland's garden path. Take the train to Milan, then onward. Her dream, her yearning, or her responsibility, her roots. She'd never said goodbye. A knock on the door. She jumped. Mademoiselle, a muffled voice inquired, would you like help with your bags? What had she learned? That her decisions must be motivated not by fear, but by desire. I'm fine, she managed to answer. She turned to look at her single leather suitcase perched upright at attention, packed with undergarments, a few shirts. Enough for forever? What did one need, really need? Thank you. She fingered the knob on the desk drawer, marble, chiseled, perfect. She waited for another knock. It didn't come. It was up to her. Warsaw, Milan. She stood. She picked up her bag. She picked up one thin ticket. Onward.
Oh, so that is the opening, and this is fast forward a year in your debut novel, The Last Woman of Warsaw, and it introduces us. We don't know which character it is yet, but you have two characters. We have Fanny and Zosia. They're very, very different women. And we know from the beginning, from this prologue and from the pages that come after it, that they're really trying to decide how they fit into this new Poland, right? It's very energetic. It's exciting. It's an amazing place to live, Warsaw in the late 30s. And they're saying, is there a place for me here in Warsaw? So tell us briefly about your two characters, Fanny and Zosia.
So Fanny is, I would say, feisty. She's around 20 years old. And Fanny grew up in a wealthy family. She's very assimilated. She speaks Polish. She goes to university. She's studying French. Her parents are divorced. This was rare at the time, but this was based actually on a real story that someone had told me about their own divorced parents at the time. And her mother is very, very concerned that she marry well. She must marry into equally high status family in the community. And Fanny wants to make art. Fanny loves fashion. Fanny has bought a Leica camera. These were new cameras at the time. And, you know, we don't think about it, but these were cameras that were portable. They didn't require intensive equipment to take a photo shoot. You could just hold a small camera in your hand. So Zosia has experienced violence in her past. Zosia has firsthand experienced anti-Semitic violence. And there was increasing anti-Semitism in this time in Poland. We talked a little bit about the political instability. There was a rise of a very right-wing nationalist and very anti-Jewish, I don't want to say one party, it was several parties, but one party in particular that were very influenced by nearby Germany and the Nazi Party as well. And there was increased violence towards Jews at this time in Poland. Not everyone experienced it. Fanny had not experienced it, but Zosia had. And she really did not see a future for herself in Poland. And she also did not come from wealth. The Great Depression had been very difficult, especially for the non-wealthy community, of course, in Poland. And she really felt like it wasn't safe there. She wanted to leave.
Right. It was not safe for her as a Jewish woman. She felt like there was rising violence against Jews. And we at first, we don't see it, but we start to go through Fanny's life, right? The privileged life where she hasn't seen it. And then she's at the university, and slowly we start to see it creeping in. And the first hints we get when Wanda, disappears. So Wanda is like this sort of shared mentor that brings these two unlikely allies, friends together. Let's talk for a minute about Wanda and her role in here.
Wanda's actually based on a real figure that I had researched for a long time, someone who was a very both a staunch socialist and political figure and an artist and a successful artist. She'd been a poet in real life, but I made Wanda a photographer. And so Wanda is someone that brings together both women because she is a photography mentor to Fanny and a movement, youth movement mentor to Zosia. And they both need Wanda. Wanda is going to help them achieve their personal goals. And Wanda goes missing. And this missing person story is what really brings Fanny and Zosia together and forces them into an odd couple relationship where they must work together to find Wanda.
If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. Ricky Fain was on the show last season, and since coming on Check This Out, his debut novel, The Devil Three Times, has been listed for, get ready for this, the Penn Open Book Award, shortlisted for the Center for Fiction First Novel Prize, and named a finalist for the Willie Morris Award for Southern Fiction. Amazing. Congratulations, Ricky. We're so excited for you. If you haven't read his book yet, check it out and listen to the episode wherever you get your podcasts or on nhpr.org, where you can find all of our past episodes. My guest today is Judy Battalion, and we are talking about her debut novel, The Last Woman of Warsaw. We talked a little bit before the break about how we are in 1938 Poland. This is a brand new Poland. There's a lot of excitement. There's a huge art scene. It is the Paris of the North. And we have these two main characters, two Jewish women who are polar opposites, and they are searching for a third Jewish woman who has gone missing. We're just starting to feel the encroachment of Nazi Germany, Soviets, right? There's sort of some dark winds that are surfacing. And Judy, you mentioned that, you know, some of these women are real, based on real women. All of this, of course, comes out of your work, your nonfiction work in The Light of Days, which, you know, I'm like head over heels for that book and the incredible work you did there. Let's talk about The Light of Days and what you mean when you say real women.
Sure, that's a great question. The Light of Days was my previous book, and The Light of Days was the story, the true story, nonfiction, of young Jewish women and teenage girls who fought the Nazis and who fought them from within the ghettos in Poland. These were young Jewish women who, you know, ran underground schools and printing presses and soup kitchens all the way through to young Jewish women who shot Gestapo men in the head, who blew up Nazi supply trains, who flung Molotov cocktails during ghetto uprisings, and many of whom worked as courier girls, pretending to be Christian, escaping at the threat of life every time, escaping the ghettos, zigzagging through the country, keeping communities connected, bringing medical help, money, plans, rescue plans, and smuggling weapons. And so that was my book, The Light of Days. I did research on that for many, many years. The Last Woman of Warsaw, my new novel, much of it comes from questions I had left over from writing The Light of Days and from the research that I had done for The Light of Days. So many of the characters in the novel are based loosely on real women that I had been reading about for many years.
Okay, before we dive into my next questions on your novel, like, can you share with us how you came across these women for The Light of Days? Because that story is unbelievable. And I think we just got to get that out there before we keep going.
Sure. The Light of Days happened really by accident. In Yiddish, we have a term, beshert. It was meant to be. This was almost 20 years ago. I can hardly believe it. I was living in London, and it was a time in my life where I was thinking a lot about my Jewish identity. I'm a very anxious person. And I started to think, you know, how much of that comes from my family background. I'm the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors. I decided to write about this, to write a piece about strong Jewish women who were not anxious, but who were confronting danger. That was my motive. And actually, I used to do stand-up comedy. It was going to be a comedy piece. I used to be funny. Anyways, I not anymore, clearly.
I'm laughing.
Well, you're easy. I went to the British Library looking up some historical figures, and I found very little. I found almost nothing. But one of the books, it was a old book, like a dusty with a blue fabric cover and gold embossed writing on the front, and it was in Yiddish. It was called Frauen in die Ghettos, Women in the Ghettos. Very unusual book. But even more unusual, I speak Yiddish. So I start flipping through this book written in 1946, and it's filled. It's a 200-page book, and it's filled with the stories of young Jewish women and teenage girls who, from the ghettos, were fighting the Nazis as part of an organized underground resistance movement. And that became the beginning of all of this, of all of this research, of The Light of Days, and of The Last Woman of Warsaw.
I just love that story. Thank you. What's incredible is that you have, through your nonfiction work and now through this novel, The Last Woman of Warsaw, you are uncovering women's stories that largely had been hidden, right? No one knew the women were doing this kind of work, especially in Poland in the 1930s and the 40s through World War II. So this is an incredible piece of historical work that you have done. And that is how you came to these three characters, Zosia, Fanny, and Wanda. They are based on real life women. And they get pulled into this struggle, and we see anti-Semitism growing. And when we talk about ordinary people, Fanny is just getting her degree in French, and she walks in one day to class, and the professor makes a big deal and says, Fanny, you need to go sit on the Jew bench. Get up, go walk over there. Let's talk about that moment.
So the ghetto benches were one of the manifestations of anti-Semitism in Poland at the time. There were other manifestations. There were restrictions and professions. There was some violence and pogroms. But university campuses were major sites of anti-Semitic activity. There had been violence on campuses. Actually, the campuses had to close down for a while in 37, 38, because there had been so much rioting. And Jewish students, I talk about this in the novel, medical students were not allowed to dissect Christian cadavers. There were quotas on Jewish students as well, in particular in professional programs. Not as much in the humanities, which is why many women who studied the humanities were still able to go to universities, which is why Fanny is a student of French in the university. But she had not come across these ghetto benches. They were actually not national policy. It was up to universities to install these policies. And it happened in Warsaw later than in other cities. But in late 37, the ghetto benches became policy in Warsaw University. And in these, it meant Jews had to sit in a particular bench in the classroom.
This is a big moment for Fanny because this is really where she starts to see the anti-Semitism really affecting her life. If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. We're talking to Judy Battalion about her brand new debut novel, The Last Woman of Warsaw. Another chilling moment in the book revolves around Wanda, the third main character, woman, although we don't really see her, but she is in every single page. We find out that she was part of a group of 16 women that were secretly rounded up and taken to secret detention centers in Poland.
So, again, this was inspired by true stories. I mean, not exactly, but inspired by. There were groups of women that were communist, and Wanda was involved with these groups, and they organized strikes at factories. They were really trying to protect and protest for workers' rights. And she gets arrested. Her and the group of women get arrested.
And she's missing. And so Zosia and Fanny have to figure out how to find her, right? Like, there's no word left. No one said, the police aren't talking, right? No one will tell them where she's been taken, who is her lawyer, who's going to represent her, when her trial's going to be. And this is heartbreaking and terrifying for these two women, right? As the tension is building, as we get closer and closer to World War II.
Yeah, they need Wanda. They need her for their personal reasons. Fanny needs Wanda to get her into an art exhibit that could change her career, that could give her a career. And Zosia needs Wanda to help her get out of Poland. And she thinks Wanda is going to have the ticket to get her out. She is scared of staying in Poland. And so they both set off to find this mentor who they both think will really help them change their lives.
And one really chilling passage in the book, you point out that Zosia and Fanny are trying to get news coverage of Wanda's arrest and for the 16 women that have been arrested. And they're going to all these newspapers and all these reporters and saying, don't you want to cover this? This is a huge story. And one reporter replies, no one's really too worried about a couple of Jewish activists right now, right? Everyone's concerned about Hitler, Austria, Czechoslovakia. This is, I think, a fantastic question for the news in this novel. Do you focus on the small, everyday, what's happening to these 16 women who have disappeared, or the bigger picture of what's happening to the countries around Poland? Where do you put your focus as a human being living in Warsaw in 1939? How did you think about that, and how did you want your characters to be thinking about that question?
What I wanted was to create characters that came from different places and influenced each other. They touched each other and they changed each other. And so as we begin the book, Fanny is, she's interested in taking pictures of skirts, dresses. That's really her obsession. She's looking at the lighting unfold on a dress. And Zosia is really political and really wants to leave Poland. She wants to create a Jewish homeland. And they end up, unintentionally, they sort of get under each other's skins and into each other's hearts a little bit. Fanny becomes much more aware of the world around her, of the dangers around her, and it shifts how she thinks of her art as well. And Zosia becomes a little more, perhaps, emotional and open to love.
If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out on New Hampshire Public Radio, and I'm talking today to Judy Battalion about her brand new debut novel, The Last Woman of Warsaw. And you also picked characters who started at a different point in the question, when do I run? So Zosia, when we meet her, is already thinking it's time to get out of Dodge, get out of Warsaw, right? This is not safe. It has already destroyed my family. This is not a future for me. And she's after Wanda because she wants a way out. Fanny, on the other hand, is like, I love it here. I'm going to be a photographer. This is my future. As we get to the end, those questions have different meaning, I think, to both characters. When do we run? Can you talk about that and how that journey happens for each of them in your debut novel, The Last Woman of Warsaw?
When do we run is a deeply emotional question for me. I myself grew up in a family of Holocaust survivors with a very high alert for danger. As I mentioned, I'm a very anxious person. And so that question motivates me personally. It's a question I ask myself. And so I had my characters asking this question as well. And for Fanny, she feels very comfortable in Warsaw at the beginning of the book in January 1938. She's grown up in a very established Warsaw family. She goes where she wants. She walks as if she owns the town. She does not feel threatened. Zosia, on the other hand, experienced firsthand anti-Semitic violence in her family, and she does not think that it's going to get better. She sees the future as being getting darker and darker, and so she wants to leave right away.
But you take us to this moment where we started the interview, when one of the women is on a train, and she has two tickets, and one is going back to Warsaw, right? Back to Poland, and one is getting out. And this decision is sort of throughout the book. So do either of them change their minds? Is it really Fanny who's growing? Like, how do they change throughout the novel?
Yes. When I first started writing this, that's exactly what I wanted. Two very different characters who started at different points in this answering the question of when do I run, now or never. And their friendship affects this decision of when do I go. In another context, the ramifications of their friendship would not be life or death. But because this is set in Warsaw in 1938, whether or not you run, the stakes are very high. If a Jew leaves Warsaw in 38, that is a life or death question. And these characters, I wanted them to affect each other so that they changed their idea of should I run or not. So by the end, Fanny realizes I got to get out of here, whereas Zosia feels no, she's tied to Poland. She must stay for love of her community, and for love of her family and her friends, and to fight.
And that's a very different character that we see from the beginning, where she's like, I got to get out of here. I got to do whatever it takes to get out of here, versus I'm coming back and I'm fighting. And that's a very big shift. I was also struck when I finished this book, I sort of missed the early 1938 Warsaw. And I never, ever thought I would say that, right? Because you gave me a view into this world that I hadn't imagined. The fashion cafe, the scenes, the vaudeville, the art, all the newspapers, right? It was such an exciting place. And for the first time when I finished this book, I mourned that. And your characters also mourn the loss of that sort of feeling that they could do anything, right? And you feel that is also a really big shift in this novel.
Yes, and I really felt like one of the points of writing this book was to mourn the lost Warsaw, to mourn. In the Jewish tradition, we say Kaddish. It's a prayer for the dead. And I felt like I wanted to say Kaddish for an art world, for a lost world of imagination that was totally decimated along with the murder of 6 million Jews.
Again, you're illuminating this whole part of Polish life that is not taught when we learn about World War II. We just didn't see this whole part. So I'm so grateful to you for bringing this back to life. Judy Battalion, thank you so much for joining me on Check This Out. I absolutely loved talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure. Thank you, Rachel.
Judy Battalion's debut novel is The Last Woman of Warsaw.
You're listening to Check This Out. I'm Rachel Barenbaum, and we are going to take a step back now and move into a new part of the show that we are calling Book Biz. This segment is where I take what I'm hearing from emerging writers on this show and out in the world and connect it to the bigger forces shaping publishing right now. Because the way books get written, sold, and read, well, it's changing. And I want to keep on top of that and really figure out what's happening and why. Today, we're going to dig into one of those shifts, what's driving it, and who it's working for. We're going to talk about digital-first publishing. Digital-first publishing means a book that is released as an ebook, often as an audiobook first, before it ever goes into print. For many emerging writers, digital first isn't just an option, it's becoming the default entry point. This is how they're getting published, and it's really a test and scale model. If they do well in digital first, they go to full traditional printing. Here today to talk about digital first publishing with us is Rachel Cantor. She is the owner and founder of Lovestruck Books. Rachel, welcome to Check This Out and the Book Biz segment.
Thanks, Rachel.
So you are a bookstore owner, founder. Let's really talk about digital first publishing from your perspective. How do you see that influencing the books on your shelves right now?
It's actually been an incredible thing to watch because it's sort of changing in real time. So what we're seeing is that increasingly online is the gold standard. That is happening first. It's coming quickly to consumers. And then if it really hits, then it's getting picked up by traditional publishers and is getting a physical publication, often with the gilded edges or the special edition component that people are buying almost as like a trophy, having already read it online.
So are people coming into your store and saying, I read this on my Kindle and I want a copy for my shelf?
Yes. And what's so interesting is that what will happen often is that if it's a self-published book that's online and then it's getting picked up by a traditional publisher, sometimes you can't get it in that time period between when it's transitioning from self-published to traditionally published. And so we'll have somebody who comes in, they've loved it online, they want a physical copy, and depending on where that author is in their sort of discussion and negotiation, we may or may not be able to get them a physical copy.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
Talk about the book business being thrown on its head, right? Like, you can't get a physical copy, and yet these authors are selling, like, they're getting a million people reading it on Kindles.
Yeah. I mean, the physical copy is almost like the reward for being really successful online. And you have these publishers that are building business models almost entirely around this. For example, Sourcebooks, which has this imprint called Bloom Books, which is a romance imprint, their entire business model is predicated upon finding self-published authors who have huge online followings, and then they publish their backlist. And their most famous example is they were the ones who published 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. They kind of like brought her into the mainstream, and they were doing this, you know, a long time ago. They started doing this kind of in the early 2000s, and now other publishers are picking up on this. And so you see a mix. Some publishers are both digital first and physical. Some are digital only too. And then you see also sometimes people are going straight from Wattpad, which is like an online fanfic community, straight to traditional publishing. So sometimes they're even like skipping a step of going to Kindle or an online platform, and they're just going straight to the publisher.
So the reason I wanted to have you on the show to talk about this, Rachel, you own the bookstore Lovestruck in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And we're really seeing this innovation, this change in the market is starting in the romance world. We're seeing it in sci-fi and thrillers as well, but romance is driving this, and romance is driving the growth in publishing right now. I mean, that's what's hot. That's what's selling. So can you talk to that a little bit? You know, because I'm seeing on this show the emerging authors that are breaking through in romance then are coming to your store.
Yep.
And they're literally changing the whole publishing model. And this is how they're getting published. Let's talk about those emerging authors and their path. What do you see from your perspective?
One of the reasons that romance like thrives in a digital first publishing space is that the faster release schedule really helps. So our romance readers are voracious. I mean, myself included, like we'll read 3-4 books a week sometimes. And so there's just huge demand. And so if you skip the traditional publishing phase, that cuts down on the amount of time that it takes to get the book into the hands of the consumer.
I just want to stop you there for a minute.
Yeah.
So when we talk about traditional publishing, the timeline is typically a minimum of 2 years from the moment the book is purchased until it hits shelves. 2 years. And when we talk about digital first publishing, we could be looking at 3-6 months, maybe at the most, you know, 10 months from the time a book is acquired to it's published.
And honestly, sometimes for the really well-established authors, they just drop a surprise release. Like sometimes Allie Hazelwood will just randomly drop an audiobook novella as like a gift to her fans. But yeah, usually with traditional publishing, as a bookstore, you're purchasing books 6 months in advance. Those books are then being published, edited, etc., a year out from when they're even going on sale to the bookstores. And then you're trying to anticipate as a bookstore what's going to be really successful. Again, with digital first, you have a much faster feedback loop. You know what's getting traction. You know what's popular. You know which authors are going to sort of be standout, exploding authors based just on the online feedback that you're seeing. You know, some recent examples of that are Daggermouth. I know she's coming on your show, which is so exciting. Congratulations. What a coup.
Thank you. I cannot wait.
But again, she's an example of somebody who sort of came out of H.M. Wolf, kind of came, you know, a little bit out of nowhere, 2025, self-published, went viral on BookTok, and then landed this major publishing deal. But there are lots of authors who are now very well established. For example, Christina Lauren started out as sort of digital first, some of their series, as well as Liz Tomford. So you're just seeing this pattern again and again that you've got romance starting as these ebooks, going viral on this platform and then going straight into these publishing deals and increasingly straight into like film and TV adaptations too. So when a book gets released, it's going straight to TV too.
Right. So this is the test and scale model that I was talking about, you know, in the introduction to this segment, right? Where publishers are willing to bet on emerging authors now if they've already tested as self-published authors. And I actually think that this is, so on the one hand, when you're self-publishing or you're digital first, you are making more money as an author,
yeah,
right? Your royalties are higher, right? You are actually making more money and you are not tied into these deals that traditional houses offer, which is you might get paid once a year, maybe twice a year.
Yep.
Jennifer Armentrout was on the show talking about that extensively, that if you went with a smaller digital first publisher, you get paid every single month.
Yeah.
The economics of this are working better for the writer.
And not only that, you're getting paid by the page read. So I have authors who will say, hey, I'm on Kindle Unlimited. Even if you don't like my book, if you could just flip to the end of the book because I actually get paid per page flip through, that would be great for me. So yeah, it's a big gamble for these authors. If they go the traditional route, they get all of the supports of a traditional marketing team. Often they're getting their tours paid for. But you're right, there is a delay in when they're seeing that check come in the mail.
But even let's push back on this comment that you just made about the tours paid for, because very few emerging authors are getting tours.
Mm.
Like you think about the Great Gatsby era of, you know, book tours and an author, like if you get signed to one of the big houses, your life is made if you're in the 1920s. But today in the 2020s, you got nothing.
Yep.
If you're a mid-list author, right, for one of the big publishers, you're nowhere. Whereas if you're digital first, maybe you might even have more of a chance to break out.
Yes, it's true. I mean, authors are on their own dime, often covering costs of going around to different bookstores and different events. And so as much as possible, we as a bookstore try to, you know, figure out ways to support those authors, especially the emerging ones. But yeah, it's an expensive business.
So do you see, you at Lovestruck Books, you're the owner and founder of this romance bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You see a lot of books coming through, a lot of authors. Do you see digital first publishing as a stepping stone into traditional publishing? Or is this really a whole new model?
I think it's both. I mean, again, I think often the reward for a very successful e-print debut is the traditional deal that you get at the end of it. And so for authors who are looking for that, I think that it very much can be a stepping stone. But as you pointed out, some authors are actually increasingly not even interested in getting those traditional deals. They want to stay self-published because economically it's more beneficial to them. They have more or like complete editorial control. It's a direct line to consumers. So they're able to kind of maintain that feedback loop that I think is really important for a lot of authors. I think that there are some imprints that lend themselves to, yeah, as you said, this new model of people who are kind of bypassing the traditional publishers.
So what does that mean for you? How do you get a digital first book onto your shelf?
I'm learning as I'm going, so I'm very much trying to figure this out and stay up to date on this trend as well. But so for a digital first book, sometimes an author will choose to publish it themselves and they'll use whatever platform they want. They'll use Amazon or they'll use Ingram Spark to publish the book. And that's how it gets into bookstores. Often they are self-promoting. They're doing consignment deals with bookstores or they're going around and doing events with bookstores that are then picking up their books. When those books sell, often that feedback is given to publishers. I have publisher reps in my store all of the time asking, hey, are there any really great local authors that we should know about? And often the answer is, yes, this book is selling like crazy. You should know about this person. And that's really exciting for these publishers because they get the scoop. And so bookstores increasingly are becoming like a source of information for them as well.
Wow. I had not heard of that side of the business.
Yeah. Yeah. It's incredible. You know, I mean, not always. The feedback's not always going all the way to the top, but I've definitely had those conversations with reps where they're like, oh, good to know that we should keep our eye on these authors.
Right. So let's go to the book Dagger Mouth. So that was self-published. I read it several months ago when it came out and loved that book. So I've been trying to get her on the show for months and I finally just booked her. And by coincidence, after she just signed a huge deal with Simon & Schuster, a huge deal with Netflix, like seven-figure deals, right?
She was in People magazine. Yep.
Yeah, like everywhere, dagger mouth. This book is so good. But right now, you can only, I believe you can still only read it on Amazon, or I think you could do Amazon print, right? Do you have physical copies of Dagger Mouth in your store right now?
So this was the one where we did, but now they're out of print because it got picked up traditionally. So there was like a period of time where you could buy it in store, and now we can't get it anymore, and we just have to wait like everybody else.
But you can still read the book. I mean, you can download it from Amazon right now and Kindle Unlimited.
Kindle Unlimited. The other thing that's interesting is, and you were asking about like how do independent bookstores sort of participate in this. So bookshop.org, which is like the independent alternative to Amazon, actually has an e-reader app. It's just called bookshop.org, the app. And so not everything that's available on Kindle is available to read on Bookshop, but that's a way that bookstores are trying to sort of participate a little bit, because you get, if you participate in bookshop.org as an affiliate, you get a percentage of sales if people select your store. And same thing with Libro.com, which is sort of the indie alternative to Audible. So, you know, there are these platforms that are showing up that are trying to help independent bookstores keep up with this trend in digital publishing, but they have yet to be as fast and efficient and as widespread as the more established platforms.
So I keep going back to this question, is digital first publishing, test and scale models, are those good for writers, for the emerging writers that come on this show? So on the one hand, you know, you have the opportunity, more of an opportunity, because more books are being published. You can get out there. Your work can get out there. People can start reading it. But at the same time, there are more books out there. There's more noise. So is this better? Like, are we seeing more emerging authors break through? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's such a hard question, because not only are there more authors out there and more books out there, but there's this relentless pressure and expectation to be self-promoting online. And so authors like have to be their own PR team. And so they almost have to have this big social media presence, which for a lot of authors is like the last thing that they want to do. But unfortunately, that is kind of how they participate in this online world. I think for some folks, that model works and that resonates and that lends itself to their personalities. And for some folks, it just doesn't. And I think that's kind of the sad reality of digital first, is that for the people that don't feel as comfortable with the social media world landscape that we find ourselves in, it's going to be tough for them to keep up unless they already have an established following that sort of predated book talk. And then they're going to have that loyalty already built in. But for new emerging authors, it's going to be really hard to participate without being online.
Wow. So there is definitely a stigma attached to digital first. There's often a feeling in the marketplace that those books are not as high quality as books coming out in print first in the traditional hardback. Do you think that that stigma is going to fall away? Do you see it? Are readers changing? Talk about that stigma and what you see in your bookstore.
So I don't think the stigma is going away, but I think it's becoming less relevant. I think the readers who are reading digital first books, like, don't necessarily care about the literary reputation of the author. Now, that's not true universally, and there are some really high quality books that are coming out online first, but I think increasingly there's almost two different communities. There's the romance community that wants books quickly, you know, as many as possible, as quickly as possible. And they're not necessarily reading those authors, you know, New Yorker interviews. Often those authors are not getting New Yorker interviews. And then there's sort of the old guard that is more interested in the more refined literary style. But again, like those authors are probably not going to be going straight to digital first for the most part. So again, I'm making these sort of sweeping generalizations, but I do kind of see them as two distinct audiences.
The book business is changing. Rachel Cantor, owner and founder of Lovestruck Books, thank you so much for joining me today on Check This Out for our Book Biz segment.
Thanks for having me, Rachel. Great to talk to you.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novels Abandon the Stars and Atomic Anna. You have been listening to Check This Out, a show where I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. Check This Out is a partnership between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I'll be back next week with another new author you should not miss. Our producer today is Jessica Hunt. NHPR's program director is Emily Quirk. Our partner, the Penn Faulkner Foundation's mission is to champion the breadth and power of fiction in America. The show is sponsored by CNS Wholesale Grocers Family of Companies, the podcast Totally Booked with Zibby and Zibby's Bookshop, and the Jack and Dorothy Byrne Foundation. Remember to go to your local library or bookstore and check out all the books we're talking about this season. Thanks so much for listening. Read on.